Welcome to the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Hartley. This podcast exists to equip and inspire your heart-centered leadership. Every week, we bring interviews with some of the greatest heart sets and mindsets on the planet. I hope the heartprint of our time spent together is that it creates new possibilities for you and all those you come into contact with. If you'd like to explore what we could make possible for you, then head to abty.co.uk/connect and book in a free 30-minute call to begin our journey. On episode 251, I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Hill, founder of the Peak Brain Institute. Dr. Andrew holds a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA and has extensive experience in the field of neurofeedback and QEEG. Peak Brain is a network of dedicated biohackers, neuroscientists, coaches, wellness providers, therapists, and trainers who can help you understand your brain and create customized plans for change towards your goals. Peak Brain wants you to know yourself, to understand your brain, and to be able to take that perspective into action. Peak Brain wants to help you demystify your brain and learn how it performs and how it works. And through neuroscience-backed interventions, they want to teach you to overcome any bottlenecks in your brain performance. You can find Peak Brain coaches at their offices across the United States, Europe, or online through their remote programs. It's episode 251 with Dr. Andrew Hill. Dr. Andrew Hill, welcome to the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast. How are you, brother?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me today.
I'm going to start with a confession. I have watched far too many crime series documentaries. Like, as a kid, I watched far too many documentaries, and that was my start of a fascination with the brain, the fascination with psychology. So I've been a lifelong student of psychology. Like, do you have a nerdy story? Like, what captured your imagination for the brain?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I was always one of these kids who had to take everything apart, you know. My dad was always a little chagrined when the entire house's power would suddenly go off because I was mucking about in the attic with something electrical and, you know, blow a fuse in the basement. Yeah. You know, when a 100-year-old farmhouse blows the power, everyone starts yelling in the house. So I had this geeky childhood, and then I was about, I don't know, 7th, 8th grade in the US, which is probably about 12, 13 years old. And my younger brother, I was living in a part of the US called New England, which is fairly wintry. And he sledded out into the street and got hit by a car and had a brain injury and spent the next 8 weeks or so in a coma and recovered from it reasonably well over many years. But initially, it was pretty striking to me as a young person seeing this consciousness status change that was quite extreme from, you know, losing a very small part of his brain, essentially. And then watching him recover. I mean, he was not a young child anymore, but I watched him over 2 or 3 years rebuild things like walking and aspects of language and other stuff. So I was both impressed by how dramatically we can have a change to ourselves from a small injury, as well as seeing this arc of transformation back into, fully functional human largely. So that really got my attention. And I ended up years later working in human services, working in group homes with developmentally disabled adults and working with acute psychiatric environments and acute called dual diagnosis. So psychiatric and drug addiction environments where people were really, really compromised. And did this work for 10, 11 years. It was pretty good at it. You know, one of these people can walk into a chaotic environment where people are deeply suffering and kind of, you know, calm things down and help people regulate a bit better. And I did that work for many years and was working at the time when I finished that more human service, you know, in the trenches work. I was working in a psychiatric hospital, lock facility. I was in charge of training everyone how to do hands-on restraints. And I was in charge of showing up first and directing them if we had to. And the healthcare system was falling apart in mental health. This is just before 2000 or just after 2000. And we had really lousy staffing. And so I was showing up again and again and again. multiple times a shift to environments that were not safe.
Mm.
And I ended up getting injured, blowing out some discs in my back, and had to leave that sort of, you know, skilled allied health work because I didn't have an advanced degree. Mm-hmm. And yet I couldn't do the hands-on, you know, direct face-to-face work I was doing because I had some injuries. So I spent some time doing case management for that hospital where I would help work on discharge planning and help do safety checks in the home, sort of like a, almost like a social worker, but without the degree, and found it fulfilling, but really missed both doing more direct person work. And I was also having trouble sort of moving up in this healthcare environment. So I was thinking about, you know, what I want to do. And I ended up leaving healthcare for a minute for a couple of years and went into high tech. And after 2 or 3 years of that, with a market correction, I left high tech. You know, there was sort of a bubble around the year 2000 that corrected. And then I missed working with people. So I saw, I've heard about this neurofeedback thing, this brain training thing. Yeah. It seems to be really germane to a lot of the suffering that I've seen, you know, especially childhood and developmental, if you will, suffering. I wonder if I can find a place that, you know, does this. And not too far away, there was an autism center that did primarily neurofeedback as their treatment or their intervention. And I had a lot of experience with atypically developed individuals. So I walked in for an internship and walked out with a job, and spent 2 years working in that environment, kind of, you know, no pun intended, having my mind blown at what I was seeing happen. Mm. You know, people with ADHD developing self-control in a matter of weeks, people without language and autism starting to produce some small language here and there, things like seizures dropping away, OCD dropping away, trauma dropping away, sensory integration issues just dropping away in a couple of months. And this really flew in the face of everything I understood.
Yeah.
I'd been working in the worst areas of human suffering, the edge cases, for 11 years at that point. And all I was really seeing was revolving doors of suffering. People would come into a hospital or an acute environment and get managed briefly for 3, 4, 5 days, get discharged out into a less safe environment, have something destabilized, come on back in again and again and again. And these were for teens and adults. The little children were, you know, essentially only stable if they were in environments that were safe and then would rapidly get into destable environments again. So I was very frustrated in this sort of holding pattern, mental health, human services piece of it. And then I was working in this neurofeedback center and I was seeing change in weeks and months, which didn't make sense based on what I thought I knew about, you know, people in the brain and suffering. And at the time in the field, now again, this is just past 2000, so we're 22, 23 years ago. And the field was not that young. The field has been around since the late 60s, mid 60s, really. But, you know, still pretty early on, 20 or 25 years ago. And there was 3 or 4 different schools of thought in the neurofeedback space that all used different technology and different ideas about how it worked and what it was doing and what the best way to approach it was. And there was, this is back in the days before the modern internet, we all hung out on news groups and Usenet arguing and yelling at each other about my way is the best. No, my way is the best. No, yeah. What you're doing is stupid. Yeah. And the field was full of this really vitriolic, you know, conflict constantly because it was a niche area full of passionate people who were trying to figure out how to advance it. And the weird thing is, of those, you know, 4 schools of thought, so to speak, the 4 churches of neurofeedback, they all had amazing results, better than traditional medicine. And yet they all said each other area of neurofeedback wasn't doing it right. So this struck me as what I call a blind men and elephant situation.
Yeah.
You know, someone's got a piece of something and they're describing it, but there's no real sense of the overarching perspective. So that provoked me to go back to grad school and study neurofeedback. So I got a PhD at UCLA and spent my time there studying laterality, left and right brain organization, as well as how a lot of the experiences we have as humans are scaffolded by the brain. It's something called cognitive neuroscience, aspects of executive function, stress, sensory, sleep. A lot of the stuff we experience is managed by the cortical tissue, the top layer of the brain. And because of that, you can start to get a little bit of a perspective on how it works because you can sort of see it with non-invasive techniques. And as I eventually went deeper into, you can change it. You can use tools to shift the brain and then remeasure it and see the changes you're experiencing. Mm. And so it starts to take this brain stuff, which includes massive amounts of suffering, at least clinically, and massive amounts of, you know, need for improved performance and understanding in non, you know, clinical environments. And we start to give people control over it and give them perspective and pierce that mystery. And that, to me, you know, I thought I was doing this because I wanted to do cool high-tech stuff with brains. But what really ended up driving my mission here was, you know, even before you make an intervention, just sitting down with someone, going over their brain data, saying, look, here's a feature in your brain. It often operates like this. What do you think? Oh my gosh, that's so true about me. Oh, instantly changes someone's relationship with their suffering. It's not instantly changed in terms of the amount of problem, but their perspective on it does a 180. It's much harder to be ashamed or overwhelmed when you understand how something works, some pain or some stress. It's just part of your body. And the brain loves to change. So when you start showing somebody their cortex, their brain activity, and you find their real trauma, ADHD, seizure disorder, sleep issue, whatever, well, there it is. And now, isn't it cool you can see it? And is this something important to you? Would you like to maybe change this? Because if we see it, well, we can stretch it and exercise it and probably make you feel something. So it flips all of this perspective of mental health from this top down, the expert giving you the treatment and deciding what's wrong and giving the label, into individuals really thinking about their individual resources that might scaffold both performance and suffering. But it starts to give you a different relationship with it. You know, if you see your triglycerides are high on a blood test, oh crap, better back off on the ice cream. You know, you see your sleep, your alpha waves are slowing down, you have some word finding issues. Well, you better hack your deep sleep so you can speed your brain back up. But it gives you this agency instead of this perspective of, ah, I'm suffering. Ah, I have a diagnosis. And to me, that was the dramatic draw, as it were, into building companies that help people do neurofeedback and things like that. That was the impetus, so to speak.
Yeah, I love that. And thank you for sharing that. And I think I can see you wearing an Aura ring, and there's a definite little big wave of like wearable technology. And it's, I remember wearing a Whoop. I had a Whoop for a good couple of years, and you know, that thing used to tell me I just never sleep enough. It's like it was telling me something I intuitively knew, but it was nice to have some accountability to make sense of stuff that was going on the inside, and then to have that kind of playback as, well, here might be some of the consequences of that. Here might be, you know, it's making, like what you say, the mysteries of the invisible kind of, you can interact with it. And if you can interact with it, you can change your personal experience. And like, you know, when we're growing up, we're often taught like the heart's a pump, the brain is a computer. And you know, the work of the Heart Math Institute have shown that the heart is far more than just a biological pump. And, and I guess from your perspective, what would be the best way to see the brain? What is the brain? Is there a consensus as to what this thing is?
A lot of the brain, both in, you know, pure science, you know, what is true, as well as at the individual level, we're often working with phenomena more than discrete details we deeply understand. When it comes to like a blood test for, you know, heart disease, they have different levels of blood products. And if your triglycerides are too high or you have too much C-reactive protein, it's a pretty discrete indication of something particular in your physiology. But when it comes to the brain, people are weird. So it's really hard to tell what's unusual, what's a problem, when you just look at someone's pattern of brain activity. You can tell what's unusual. Like, I look at your brain and say, aha, you've got lots of theta here, or your alpha waves are unusual speed, or your beta is doing this connectivity thing. But I don't necessarily know what it means from that observation of your brain. I will have some guesses, some plausibles. You know, people are unusual. So when you look at a brain, I can tell, compared to the average person your age, here's some amplitude, some speed, some connectivity that are a little unusual. Aha. Now this part of the brain, these brain waves, here's what can happen. Here's some plausible ideas. Does this ring true? Is this valid? And at the level of EEG, of brain waves, the stuff you can see somewhat reliably include all of the, I call them regulatory features, the stuff that's meant to change as it touches the world. These are attention, sleep, stress, and all the anxiety stuff that, you know, fits there. Social function, sensory function, those things are meant to adjust. And so if you can figure out where they operate and how they operate, you can apply pressure and you can literally change your executive function, trauma response, OCD. And it gives people, again, this sense of control and less of a sense of, something's happening to me that has a name. Somebody gave me a label. And I find that is, again, the most important part often.
Yeah. Without being too conspiratorial, there are a number of documentaries out there that reveal that these big tech companies know far more about the nature of the brain, and they're using that understanding to capture attention, keep people's attention on things like social media. It's almost like they've reverse engineered that, and I guess so much of that is happening without us even knowing. You know, I let my kids go on their iPads every now and again, right? And because I know some of these things that are bad enough with a phone at my age, let alone a child without that regulatory capacity. And the things that pop up, the noises that they make, the sensory, it's wired for their attention, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's also not just reverse engineered, but sort of forward engineered in that when we're producing videos for YouTube or titles for our podcast, we are now trained to have little, clickbaity, little short attention grabbing things that create an engagement, an attentional engagement. And then the rules for doing some of these media things are, okay, after you grab them, then you got to deliver. And then you got, we're taught by this, by the YouTube algorithm and the Apple podcast algorithm. So while we may not be thinking about doing bubblegum and, fast food type of media, that's what's rewarded. So it's a little bit difficult for us to sometimes have a genuine experience, I think, when we're reacting to those pressures.
It's having consequences on a mass level, I think, with people's, their mental well-being. The epidemic is one of mental health crises and attention and focus. And I'd just love to know from your perspective then, what are the hallmarks, would you say, of a healthy brain? How would we know when the brain is healthy? Or maybe you can explain that from the perspective of what an unhealthy brain is like.
Yeah, I mean, again, brains are so variable and our experiences across people are so different that not just our high performance is different, but our suffering can be different. So what I would say is, instead of thinking about, is my brain optimal? I mean, I look at brain mapping or pictures of brain activity, and they're not showing what's good or bad. They're showing what's unusual. And so when I sit down with someone showing lots of unusual, bright, colorful patterns of their brain, what's all that red? It just means you have large amounts of beta or low amounts of this. By itself, not that much. Let's figure out if it matters to you.
Yeah.
So there's no real particular, master plan or perfectly healthy brain. And when looking at your brain and trying to make judgments about it, I wouldn't compare you to some perfect pattern of a brain. I'm just compare you to all the folks your age or a few thousand people your age and see on a bell curve, what sticks up? Where are the outliers? And then figure out if the outliers, if the patterns, the biomarkers are classic. Do they represent things that are often true? We call these phenotypes. So having a high theta beta ratio is the ADHD phenotype. Having slowed alpha is the speed of processing, delayed recall for words and names. It's phenotype. Having a front midline hot spot in betas, obsessiveness. Back midline, trauma response and rumination. These aren't always true. If you have a hot back midline, your posterior cingulate, chances are pretty good that you're ruminating and threat sensitive. Maybe you have some PTSD, but maybe you're a lifeguard or a mom with 9 kids who lives in a high energy state and loves it. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a problem. It's just unusual. So I walk through brain activity with you and say, look, here's some things. And they usually make sense. If I'm not telling you novel things. I'm saying, hey, here's a measurement. It often means this kind of thing. Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Or sometimes, that doesn't sound like me. Okay, this is you. This is a normal pattern for you. Let's move on. And I tend to find about between 2 and about 10 things per person that rise the level of, hey, these are reasonably conserved across people. These often get in the way, often represent performance opportunities. What do you think? And so I'm not giving somebody a diagnosis. I'm not saying you have ADHD or PTSD. I'm saying, look, the left side of your brain doesn't sustain focus as well. Would you like to clean off the mud off that spotlight, make it brighter? Oh, you would. Now, a psychologist would say, look, you're inattentive and you have ADD. Let's work on that. I'll treat you. Instead, I'm saying, look, your left mid-motor cortex, can't sustain vigilance, also looks like you aren't sleeping well. All these are important to you. Great. Let's work on those resource levels. And so you get people the ability to change without taking on the weight of that diagnostic label or the stigma. Doesn't mean there's not a place for therapy and psychological and medical perspective on this stuff. There really is, but it's not the only way to deal with it. You shouldn't require a middleman to work on your own physiology. You should know it, you know, like the Oura Ring you mentioned earlier, you know, 10, 20 years ago, none of us had sleep trackers.
Yeah.
And now we're shamed by our Oura Rings and Loop straps every morning and go, oh crap, better back off on the ice cream or, you know, fast before bed or get up in the morning and walk. Now, you were joking about the Oura Ring. For a while, I had both wrists covered from wrist to elbow with sleep trackers. rings on both hands. I had three rings and about seven or eight different wristbands. I was comparing them because I work with a few hundred clients a year, typically around the world, and we ask them about sleep every day. Because when you work on the brain, no matter what you're doing, you're tapping into regulatory features that will flex when you work out. When you go to the gym for your, you want to get, you know, nice and trim, or you want to work on your back injury, other stuff happens when you're in the gym. You get a little bit of a flex of the whole system. That happens in neurofeedback. So we watch your sleep day to day because changes in onset, depth, dreaming happen as you gently push on the brain, and how you push on the brain will affect how the sleep unfolds a tiny bit. So you can use that as like a gauge. Hey, how'd that workout feel? Wow, I was wired after it and couldn't fall asleep. Oh, okay, that was too fast for you. Let's back off a little bit. How'd that feel? Oh, that felt amazing. I had crazy dreams all night long. Oh yeah, your plasticity is going up. Let's repeat that a couple of times and see if you notice stuff during the day. So you can start to really demystify the machine. And that is really, I think, the big value here, more than any particular thing we do. Even just looking at brain data and just helping reframe your stress response, your speed of processing, your whatever it is, into the actual physiology. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people who come in their 40s and 50s who are a little bit worried about their memory, thinking they're having age-related memory stuff, and they're not. And you can quickly look at their brain and go, oh, alpha speed is slow. That's actually speed of processing. So you're noticing it when you're reaching for information, but it's not your memory, it's speed. And the reason for it, oh, your delta waves are super fast. Are you tired all the time? Oh, you are? Yeah, your sleep deprivation is the e-brake on in the car. I guess we say handbrake in the UK, on in the car. And that's causing a drag in the system, which is why you're pushing so hard. So you can kind of start to grab the data and really paint out things that ring true for people. And then from then on, if I teach you how your sleep works, oh my gosh, I'm not getting good deep sleep. I know that. My Oura Ring says it. Oh, my alpha waves are slow. What do I do? Okay, don't eat before bed. Get up early. Go for a walk. See how your circadian cueing, you know, supports you. A couple weeks of that, you start to feel different. A couple months of that, map your brain and show the change.
Yeah. So, it's just, there's just so much hope in that, isn't it? Because I think so many people are led to believe that it's a fixed state. Oh, that's just the technology I've been given. And it makes me think, because you're talking about the ADHD conditions, is it an adrenotype of what you said, the theta and the beta? And I know that there's a number of things, you know, like binaural beats that are out there that they're trying to change brainwaves, meditation, a variety of different things.
Meditation's huge. Meditation's massive, and everyone should be doing it. You know, 5-10 minutes every morning would do wonderful things. Hugely impactful. Meditation is about the best thing you can do that you have access to that's not a normal, if you will, day-to-day routine thing that can make a huge impact. And then sleep hacking and other stuff you should be doing, and dietary stuff. We, you know, we all tend to be shorted on protein and have excess sugar. As a population of creatures, we could do better there. But binaural beats, just to harp on that for a second, they don't do anything. They're nonsense. Human brains, as far as we can tell, don't have what's called a frequency following response. The early research on binaural beats showed that if you pulse an offset sound, the brain may pick it up, but that was in animals. Humans don't seem to have that frequency following response, never been determined. I was very excited about binaural beats when I got to grad school. I thought, oh my gosh, I can do some cool research. So I spent 6 months doing placebo-controlled, double-blind binaural beat research and found nothing again and again and again in behavior, in physiology, in performance. And most of the literature out there is extremely poor and weak and basically disproves that it does everything. So while there might be something there, I think what we're seeing when people express some experience from binaural beats is they're using it as a meditation focus. It's another flavor of music. It doesn't really have a special frequency. Like when you do the alpha binaural beats, it's not making alpha waves. Mm-hmm. Closing your eyes makes alpha waves. So, or meditating can take your theta up and bring your beta down. So that's what's doing it. And the binaural beats become an anchor, a focus for that meditation, but they're not magical. So don't pay $50 or whatever for a special audio track.
Yeah.
Find your favorite auditory focus for meditation and practice that. And you'll, you know, get as much out of it, I would guess.
Yeah. Cause I think what you're saying is that, if we learn, cause I'm trying to figure out how much of this is, chicken and egg, right? How much of the ADHD is manifest in me because of my brainwaves, or how much of my environment is influencing?
Mm.
Like, what's your perspective? Yeah.
On that? Yeah. ADHD is not an acquired phenomena, but it's a fluffy, bucket. It's got an amorphous, set of criteria such that ADHD is not just now the diagnostic thing your psychologist says. It's a cultural thing. We all know what ADD is. I mean, just the label ADD, there's not been an actual diagnostic label called ADD since 1987. That was when it left the DSM manual. It's all ADHD with different letters after it for mixed or primarily inattentive or combined or whatever. But we all know what ADD means and we all use that. Oh, I'm so ADD today. But it's worse than that. Your kid has some performance or behavior issues at school, and the school nurse or the teacher, oh, they have ADD, put them on stimulants.
Right.
And so it's this, you know, it's a problem in that way. But ADHD is not an acquired phenomena. It's also not a pathology per se. It's a normal human variant. 20-30% of humans have different executive function. It's like 10 to 20% of us are left-handed. You know, something around the same percentage has decreased inhibition and notices all the patterns and processes very rapidly and tends to attach to outside stimulus. The hunters are good at noticing the animal or reacting to the environment, but a hunter's not going to do real well in the boring evening campfire discussions. You know, they need that intensity, the hunters versus gatherers. This is more of a theory than a true brain proven phenomena, but it is a normal variant, and ADHD only gets in the way when it's really extreme or it's poorly matched the environment. You're an accountant sitting working on spreadsheets and that's it, and you're strongly ADHD, you may need to do things to manage sitting and focusing in a discrete low intensity way if you want to do that. More often you've probably picked a career that's not that because it didn't play to your strengths, and instead you're doing something that's a bit more dynamic and intense and has variable demand. You'll soar in those environments.
But
more than the diagnostic label, I mean, you're born with having high theta, which is squirrel, you know, disinhibition, or you're born with having high alpha, which is, sorry, what? Huh? ADD, inattentive stuff, relative to the beta waves. And the ability to shut off the theta and alpha and surge the beta when you decide to focus, that's what executive function is to some extent. It's the organization of that. And if your theta is generally high, you're going to notice every single thing around you and have a hard time focusing unless things are intense. But you're going to focus better when things are intense than somebody without that state. So this is why we get high performance individuals with ADHD doing things like stock trading or extreme athlete stuff. You know, really, really strong athletes have a lot of disinhibition, but under high intensity, things still and become crystal clear. So they can't necessarily sit and do their taxes, but you know, I want that person on a football pitch, you know, running through and noticing all the patterns and changing gears. So if it gets in your way, if you, you know, if the football player's wife is mad because you can't do the dishes or, you know, have a conversation without getting distracted, well then, okay, work on your ADHD, but it's not really a pathological. It's a normal human variant. We need people who can react faster, see the patterns, fight better. And we need people that can sit and weed the plants and notice the slower moving information and be more careful in our decision-making. So normal human variant.
And I think that would have been made much more obvious in a world where, you know, let's just take the Lost scenario, that TV show where everyone just ends up on an island. You just fall into your natural strengths, right? I watched that program for 10 years. What a waste of my life. But because the ending was not satisfactory.
I know. It's so sad.
But, You know, I think that situation, everyone, I know it's a TV show, but everyone then deployed their strengths, right? And I think the world is, would be like that if we didn't have the systems and structures like, you know, academia. I've got a 10-year-old and an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old that go into a schooling system. One of them has learned how to advance very well. They're playing the game. The other one has gone, I'm not playing by your rules. I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Equally capable, but not interested to perform. And, you know, so there'll be many, many people out there that not only go into the school system like that, they'll go into the workplace like that. And I think there's some huge implications in what you're talking about, not only on the individual leader and how they can optimize themselves, but also how they can optimize an environment of other people with brains. You know, what are some of the huge implications for leaders from the work that you're seeing?
So if you're somebody who manages people who have different brains than average, which you do, if you work with people, then you have weird people. That's just how people work. You know, only about a third of us are average. The rest of us are kind of weird. So you have some unusual people. And if you have people whose executive function is not typical, you know, you can do things to maximize productivity and make their jobs easier. Like give people standing desks or desks that change height if they have ADHD, or structure meetings that have that are shorter and have, you know, defined outcomes. Think about some of the productivity hacks you might use as an individual and bring them into the level of the company. Things like David Allen's GTD, where you break down, or getting things done, where you break down tasks into categories and you think of the blockers, the next actions, and things you can get accomplished. And then you work through sprinting, you know, so Pomodoro techniques, which is the tomato timers. You sprint through 20-minute chunks. Those things are hugely impactful for an individual trying to structure their time, but for a company as well. You got a bunch of creatives.
Yeah.
Give them balls to sit on and standing desks and create dynamic, sensory-rich environments for them to be fed by, and look at things like structuring time and deadlines, and realize that's a bit of a problem for some of the artistic and creative types.
Yeah.
And so work on structuring it and making discrete, smaller sets of deliverables important.
Yeah.
Because the ADHD person is going to think they can do everything, think it's going to take no time at all, because they understand it instantly from the time they see it. But the idea of all the steps involved to get there, there's a temporal discounting or an effort discounting.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I can do that. I got 6 weeks to do it. I know how to do that. That's easy. But then you're 10 days before it and you're starting it and structuring and freaking out. And that's the problem with ADHD. And you as a manager, a leader, can scaffold that. Make some breakpoints for projects. Give reinforcement before the end of the project.
Yeah.
You know, help people navigate, be a mentor more than a boss, you know, a leader more than a manager. These are important things when somebody has different resources. And that can be true, not just of ADHD, but somebody who has anxiety or sensory social. You may have somebody in your office whose sense of humor isn't typical, or whose eye contact isn't, or whose language is a little bit weird. You know, you can have exceptionally intelligent people with quirky social skills who are really valuable for you, both in your company culture as well as the output of the product. So maximizing these people's enjoyment of their job, everyone, all of us, our enjoyment of our job is not that hard to do if you think about some of the resources that might need to be either supported or allowed to run free. I mean, you got somebody who's highly productive in sprints or highly productive in certain tasks, and it's really useful for your company. Great. Set them free. You know, you'd be surprised at what people can do when they're chasing things they find stimulating. So that's how I tend to run my company. I have a company called Peak Brain, and we have maybe just shy of 20 people, not a huge company, but it's about 8.5 years old, and we ran another company for about 3 years before this. It's very similar. And my management style, because I get a lot of people who are early career, and I've trained them. A lot of my first batch of employees were my students, then my interns, then my employees, then helped start companies with me. So nice, rich, you know, decade of instruction with some of these folks. What I found is when people start working for your company, you can, you know, pretty quickly figure out, for many of them, there are some things they really enjoy and some things they really don't. And if your company, the structure, the role that you have allows it, then you can get a massive multiplier on productivity and sidestep some of the classic constraints of productivity if you're just really playing to people's strengths and not making somebody, you know, someone has poor auditory listening or you know, doesn't show up to meetings on time. Don't make them do 3 meetings a week for an hour. You know, have them do stand-ups, have them do check-ins, have them do end-day summaries. So really think about someone's executive style like you might be if you're a teacher. You might think about learning style, which is not really a thing.
Yeah,
it's more about the material than the person. But think about the material in your workplace. Is the material stuff that you can put down a particular channel and, you know, get something out of it? You mentioned your kid, you know, one is thriving in the system and one is like, ugh, this is annoying. You probably have some of this in the UK, but in the US, we have a private education program called the Montessori, which finds a kid like your other one and says, ah, what do you like? Oh, you like manga. Oh, you like football. Oh, you like this. Let's funnel everything through that one channel.
Right,
all your math is manga. All your art is manga. All your politics is manga, you know, whatever. And you funnel everything through that one thing the person cares about. And suddenly the person who is resistant against the systems is leaning in,
engaged,
and accelerating and surpassing what you expected. So.
The reason I was laughing a minute ago is I spent 12 years in the UK police service in a variety of kind of organizational development roles. And our calendars would be back to back. You know, there'd be so much business. We're running meeting to meeting, and then we get to one meeting and it's right, we've got 1 hour to be innovative. Let's be as our most creative thinking, innovative, let's strategize.
Innovation now.
Let's be innovative now. And I was like, I'm innovative. Like let me run wild. Like I love a good, like you can see my whiteboard, like, but not when I haven't made sense of my last meeting. I'm thinking about my next one in all things in between. And I think it's really powerful what you've just said, because it requires a style of leadership that is beyond getting stuff done, thinking about how do I create the environment to get that stuff done through and with people at their most optimum state, rather than just hammer, hammer, hammer.
And you may need to change how you expect work to be done. And you definitely might need to change how you train people. You know, different people may have different needs. And that matters a lot once you start moving into more complex roles. If someone is just, you know, putting rubber bands on packages, doesn't really matter who it is. And you can ramp up the intensity. And now it's more about keeping them from falling over through boredom and making errors. Mm-hmm. But if you have a complex skill set, you know, most of my employees are coaches, quote unquote, mix of EEG technicians, tech support, education, all kinds of stuff. But it's really coaching practice the same way your high level coach in a gym might be. Mm-hmm. They know the equipment. They know how to get results. They don't necessarily know what your goals are or why you want to get them, but they're going to help you build towards your goals. Mm-hmm. That's really how we work. But I have to teach my people, the employees, a fairly large different set of skills, or they come in with skills, tech skills, EEG skills, interpersonal skills. You know, I work with folks that have a lot of anxiety or ADHD, and, you know, our coaches have to learn to not be frustrated when that person with ADHD or anxiety doesn't show up to their meeting early on in the process with us, at least before the ADHD is gone. But the idea is that we end up needing to sort of tend different skill sets. You know, some people are exceptionally good. A client is suffering and they can move right into that, you know, careful listening, calm, commiserating, sympathetic mode. And other folks are like, oh, I'm so frustrated. My client's not getting better. You know, and you have to really teach different skill sets. You know, I spend more time teaching data analysis with one person and more time helping somebody realize how anxiety works and why there may be some unskillful behavior coming back at our coaches from this person who's chronically stressed and traumatized and angry. It's a different set of skills across our coaches that might need to be, you know, brought up. But eventually, at least from my perspective, all of our coaches are pretty wonderful. So I think humans are really, really variable. It's not really that people cannot learn. You know, somebody with ADHD could learn to become an accountant if they really wished, and sit and do boring spreadsheets. Yeah. I may be biased, but it's really about if you can structure the stuff you're engaging with to ways you feel that you want to.
Yeah, I think it's powerful. I think, you know, when you say the question, there's no right or wrong. There is just when you play that back, it's like, does that work for you? Does that help or do you hinder the life that you want to live? And, you know, some people have the self-awareness to put themselves in a situation which enables them to shine and bring forth the best of themselves. And others are suffering without realizing why that is. I want to pick up on something you just said. And I know we've touched on this a number of different times, but I really want to package your answer to this, which is you just said when the ADHD is gone.
Yeah.
Well, what some people have been led to believe that that's it. I've got that for life. I have. Like, what's your research and your experience?
Yeah, generally ADHD is built in. You're born with it and it develops, but you can change it. There's lots of ways to change a brain. Many are somewhat slow and gradual, and they're happening so slowly you don't even notice they're a function of change. You just think you're growing and developing, but the brain actually is learning and reacting to the world you're in and changing. And other ways of changing the brain are actually really fast. You can start to get a handle on how this works if you learn how the brain works. So we do something called brain mapping or quantitative EEG, which is a resting fingerprint of resources. Alongside that, we do executive function testing or ADHD testing, you know, go, no-go tasks. And when someone comes in with complaints that are in that landscape, either diagnosed or not, they generally on a bell curve are coming in with scores that are 1 to 3 standard deviations off the mean, like really problematic, excessive theta, excessive alpha, 2-3 standard deviations.
So we're talking 2.5% of people.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, it's the more extreme cases or on a performance test, you're having somebody on a bell curve who's coming in, you know, the average score on testing for human performance is usually for most tests, age normed, and you set it up. So 100 is average and 15 points is a standard deviation. So 85 to 115 is typical. And with ADHD, you have 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, so 70s, 2 standard deviations off the mean. That's what you tend to get in performance, whether or not it's a diagnosed ADHD or a post-COVID brain fog or a concussion. When there's executive difficulties, that's how they jump out in data. And generally the brain and the performance data match, and they match the person's experience. They're converging and you're kind of picking up something real. With that case, which is most cases of seeing actual difficulties, you can then exercise the brain waves, the theta down, the beta up that you're seeing. Half an hour, roughly 3-4 times a week, you start to feel it 3 or 4 sessions in. You don't feel it right away usually. And you start making changes to the brain activity progressively. And if you do something like 40 or 50 sessions of neurofeedback, which is 3 months, you can usually make 2 standard deviations of permanent change in executive function, which takes severe ADHD and makes it mild. It takes moderate ADHD and gets rid of it. And the literature shows in children and adolescents, at least, that's where most of the literature is, it shows good long-term change in 6 months, 12 months, 5 years, and 10 years. In so you're really getting a pretty thorough shift. And when I show you that the way we do brain mapping and neurofeedback is we map at the beginning, we map every 20 or 25 sessions. So often you might do 3 months or 4 months and map 3 times. And you're seeing the changes that you're feeling build up as you go. So day to day, we're asking, how's your sleep? How's your stress? How's your mood? How's your mother-in-law? Whatever. And you're reporting variable experiences. Ah, my mother-in-law was a jerk today. I'm so mad. Oh, okay. We'll try this and try that. And, you know, personal trainer metaphor here. But then things start to shift. And it's really, really rewarding to sit down with somebody 6-8 weeks after they start, go over their second brain map and show 2-3 standard deviations of improvement in executive function and brain activity, and have them go, oh my gosh, my mom's been noticing this. My wife's been noticing this. My teacher says I'm really focused now. I'm so proud of myself. Look at your brain, young person. You've changed it. Isn't that awesome? Cool. What else do you want to do? So it really takes this, you know, lifelong almost stigma and frustration about not controlling ourselves. And it starts to give people control.
Right.
So influence, that's my real
and
big
empowerment.
Very much so. Yeah. Agency is my watchword here. I like to think of this idea that in much of mental health and psychology and medicine, we rely on somebody giving us information. It's this top down. It's got this, you know, psychology transference. Your therapist, your provider has the expertise and the knowledge and the care, and they create a container and you're inside of it. That I feel is not as empowering as it could be. And so I tend to use the educational aspects of teaching you how your brain works to sort of thrust agency upon you instead of creating a container and treat you. So that as you go progressively, learn more and more, map your brain more and more often, hack your sleep more and more often, try to push your brain around and feel it change. After a few months of that, when you've worked through a lot of suffering of ADHD or trauma, or your seizures are reduced, the neurofeedback was discovered because it reduces seizures sort of by mistake in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And the literature says that it reduces seizures by 50% roughly. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a result that poor, not once. It's almost always like, oh my gosh, my seizures are reducing really quickly. Wow. So when you give people change and it starts to show up in a couple of weeks, it's a very different landscape than medication, which can take weeks to work, or psychology, or, you know, therapy work where you're sort of working through years and years of stuff to make small change. There's a very rapid change for regulatory features: attention, stress, sleep, mood, attention, sensory, social, speed of processing. These are things you can get in and change. So that's really the takeaway, is that you don't have to think about the diagnostic label. You can be like, where am I suffering and what is in the way? Probably measure it and then come up with strategies. And neurofeedback, you know, to change the EEG, yes, we make very large changes in a few months, but there's lots of ways to change your brain. I've occasionally had somebody come in, you know, a dad brought their 17-year-old in a couple of years ago. My son's going to college next year. We're really concerned. He can barely get out of his own way. High school was horrible. What are we working with, doc? Okay, let's look. Oh, wow. Yeah. A lot of executive function difficulty, a lot of impulsivity. But look at this. Your speed of processing. You're a 12-cylinder sports car. Oh, my gosh. And look at this. You can notice everything. Oh, my gosh. And over here, you're picking up all the emotions, right? Oh, wow. Okay, you're kind of a cool brain.
Yeah.
And telling the 17-year-old this, I think, okay, great. Person has tons of needs. Going to come back in for neurofeedback shortly. Don't hear a thing. 4 years later, get a call from the dad. Hey, just wanted to call you and thank you. My son just graduated top of his class. Just hearing that his brain was not broken and understanding how some of the features work and where he can work around it gave him enough sense of power and control. He went from being a kid who would not do anything in high school to self-motivating, to finding ways to strategize, to structure his time, to move through problems. Just hearing how he worked gave him enough perspective to make change. So you don't need to do neurofeedback. My goal is not to sell anyone neurofeedback. It's to sell you agency. Shift happens. Get yours. Yeah. Take some control.
I love that.
But it doesn't really matter how you shift. It's really about what your goals are and what you want to do with your brain. So.
One of my guests recently, his name's John Eldridge, and he talks about a Christian perspective around masculinity and males. And one of the underwriting questions he says that the masculine has to try and answer is just, have I got what it takes? I.e. that there's something about competency that is important to this masculine journey. And I guess what you've just said is a wonderful example of actually, it's not a question of am I competent, it's where am I competent? It's where do my strengths lie? Where do I work? And now I know that. Now you've given them the gift of that awareness. It's like, oh, well, I can start building my life around where I am competent, and I can start doing things in line with how I actually do work rather than just constantly swimming upstream.
And also knowing how it works can give you a sense of what you're already doing. I mean, if you're kind of burnt out in your mid-years and look at your brain and find that your delta waves are very excessive and your alpha waves are running slow, that's a function of your deep sleep not being well maintained. And you're like, oh yeah, my Oura Ring tells me I only get 20 minutes. It shames me every morning. Yeah, you're right, doc. Okay, yeah, well then that's what we're seeing. And you're also having word finding issues and short-term memory, and you're burnt out at 3 p.m. All that sounds right? It does. Okay. It doesn't really necessarily, you know, now put somebody in an alley. Oh, sorry, that's it. It's the start of the conversation. It's like, okay, well, here's this stuff. You know, sir, you know that you're eating before bed and staying up too late and burning the candle. You know that. Here's the impact of it.
Right.
So now that you see this, this actually dovetails with other stuff you care about that you don't love and resources. Okay. Now you know it's important. So don't eat before bed. That will cascade and deeper sleep, better word finding, better resilience, yada, yada, yada. So just getting a handle on how the system works can give you an intervention that you can then really lean into and make great change. No matter how you make changes, you know, change can happen. So
much of this biohacking stuff is about undoing all of the things that are hidden in plain sight, isn't it? The blue lights, the, you know, coffee as soon as we wake up, not looking at, you know, looking at our screens as soon as we wake up rather than getting sunlight into the eyes. For me, when I embarked on this leadership journey, when I started to get more pressure and responsibility, once I became a parent, the best thing I did was start to get up early. I started to get really early and I would go to the gym. I'm a coach and I lead a personal development community, but I would always stop short of giving that advice to say, hey, you need to do this, because I was only speaking from my lived experience. Hey, it was working for me. And I knew that this was working for me. I knew that I felt better as a human being. But then my Whoop was like, dude, you're not sleeping enough. Like, and I was like, I'm not really sure. So then I start to prioritize sleep and I miss a few kind of gym sessions early morning. And I'm like, I don't feel better. And then I hear you on a podcast. You're like, yeah, I get up at 4 a.m. several hours before sunrise and all of your, you know, your lived experience is better. And so I'd just love to know your perspective on what is the significance of early mornings and why does that have such a detrimental effect on your brain?
Well, I mean, I'm getting up early, but I'm also going to bed early. So, you know.
There's wisdom right there, because I probably wasn't burning the candle.
The time to sleep in is the start of the night, not the end of the night. Your morning wake time is extremely important for circadian entrainment. In fact, I have the three big ones are: don't eat before bed, because you need a 2-3 hour window of clearing blood sugar. People often don't know why, and it's really important. It helps you understand that you should do it. When you have melatonin release, as the day gets later, melatonin starts to release late in the day. Melatonin suppresses pancreatic insulin response completely. So as melatonin starts to be released, you have a sudden drop of insulin in your system. This is why you get snacky at the end of the day. Dropping insulin makes you want to, you know, put more sugar in, because you have the ability to release more insulin. Oh, better store some fuel. But we have this snacky phenomenon. If you resist it, then you have lower blood sugar as you fall asleep. If you have lowish blood sugar, you have a very strong release of growth hormone when you're sleeping. If you have any blood sugar, you have no growth hormone. So if you go to bed, because if you eat before bed, you wake up fat and tired and hungry. But if you fast before bed, you wake up full of energy and lean. It's very strange. So the reason is the circadian rhythm is pushed by when we eat. The number one exogenous cue, the number one cue from the outside world for circadian, is not light. It's not when you sleep. It's when you eat. So eat for the time zone you want to live in when traveling. Fast before bed. Get up early. So today I get up at 3:30. Doing this podcast at 5:30 my time. I usually get up I set an alarm for 4. I'm usually waking up just before it because I'm well and trained. Mm-hmm. When I don't get up early, when I'm staying up until, you know, 10 at night or something, 10:30 at night, and getting up at, you know, 5 or 5:30, even 6, my sleep is different, dramatically different. It is not as deep. My Oura Ring shames me more. There's just not as much recovery. I don't stay well and trained, and I need more sleep. If I go to bed late and get up even relatively early for, you know, modern humans, get up at 6:30 or 7, my sleep quality is not the same as it is if I go to bed earlier, you know, 8:30 at night, and get up at 3:30 or something. My sleep's amazing, and my Oura Ring, you know, gives me a crown or something. So, I find that if we're well and trained, then the amount of sleep we need reduces. This happens in neurofeedback, by the way, almost every time when someone's sleep is off. You know, they're sleeping enough hours, but the quality is not great and they're always burnt out. One of the first things that happens a few weeks in is suddenly their amount of sleep compresses, where they go from like 9 hours of crappy sleep to 7 hours of amazing sleep all at once. And they're like, whoa, it's weird. I'm waking up way earlier than usual, but I feel good. Way less sleep, but I don't understand why. Well, you're getting more deep sleep in the sleep that you're getting. Mm-hmm. And back to our sleep tracker obsession. Folks, if you have a sleep tracker, please ignore the REM numbers. They don't mean anything. They're made up by the providers. They're not valid. Mm-hmm. Deep sleep is the only thing you should care about on the sleep trackers. It's the only thing you have control over besides total. Yes, you can control your hours in bed, but deep sleep is the garden. You can't control your REM, even if you can measure it on a sleep tracker, which you cannot. Even if you can measure it, it wouldn't matter. REM is like blood pH. It regulates tightly. If you throw it off too far, bad things happen. So if you have issues with REM, you're crazy. You're hallucinating. You're having like really, really bizarre experiences. Mm. By the time your REM is a problem, you got bigger issues than your REM. So don't worry about your REM because you can't really control it. You can't really measure it. And you're always having it. Those folks who don't think they dream at night, you're dreaming, but you're not having enough deep sleep to consolidate the memory of having had the dream.
Mm.
So lack of dreaming is a lack of deep sleep, not an actual lack of REM.
Mm-hmm.
So focus on the deep sleep. And 2 days, 3 days of behavior before every night will impact how you regulate. Mm. So you can play with fasting before bed. You can play with moving your intense energy or intense exercise, the kettlebells, working out, that kind of hardcore raw stuff. Move that to the afternoon between 3 and 7 p.m. That's when cortisol is naturally lowest and cardiac output is highest. So having a cortisol spike will burn off the blood sugar, the body fat, the energy, and then leave you nice and relaxed for bed. So to back up a little bit, in order of importance, fast before bed, get up early. The wake time is important. Evening light doesn't matter so much. Morning light matters a little bit. The suprachiasmatic nucleus above the or the vasopressin system above the optic chiasm, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, its main job is to notice morning light.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only sensitive to light that's in the air for up to an hour after sunrise happens. That's it. So if you're getting up out of bed more than an hour after sunrise, you aren't getting that morning light cue. And as important as light is activity. So to stack all these things, fast for 2-3 hours before bed, get up early 7 days a week. And when you first get up, don't go work out hard. Don't go grab coffee first thing. Don't become sedentary on the couch first thing. Do 10 minutes of something that's intense enough to burn off the energy, the cortisol, the glycogen that woke you up, but not so intense that it calls for more. Don't do your CrossFit, your kettlebells, your steady state 10-mile run first thing in the morning. Do your 5 sun salutations, your Tai Chi. Get your wife a cup of coffee from the place in the corner. You know, do that low key to wake the entire body up. You know, evolutionarily, wake up in the morning with no food in the cave and go hunt in the jungle for chickens. The body's meant to do that. It's not meant to go sit in the couch and start eating sugar. It's not meant to jack up your cortisol in the first hour after you wake up because cortisol is already high. If you slam coffee or go work out intensely first thing in the morning, you're calling for cortisol against receptors that have just been occupied. You might create cortisol resistance. You're actually having less body fat reduction than you would if you worked out in the afternoon, perhaps, because you're sensitive to cortisol at that point. So fast before bed, get up early, go for a walk. I don't care about light. I don't care about screens. I don't think it's a big deal. If parents are concerned about screens, you know, it's more about the habit for your kid, the transition time. The circadian rhythm is not that impacted by screens. Humans can push, can absorb 1 hour a day of disruption. And that's about what a screen does. If you wake up at 11 p.m. and look at your phone, it pushes your circadian rhythm by about 1 hour, which you absorb. You shrug it off, basically. So I don't care about that too much. I also think all of the biohacker emphasis on blue blocker glasses is nonsense. There's good research showing that the intensity of light is what matters. The color is irrelevant completely. So, and also human eyes are meant to see full spectrum light.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm one of those people who can't tolerate those orange or red glasses. If I put them on, guarantee 5 minutes later, I've got an actual significant migraine because my brain does not like the constrained signal coming in of one color for some reason.
So if I'm putting on the red filter on my iPhone, I'm just the guy with a red filter on my iPhone rather than actually being a biohacker.
Yeah. So exactly. It's interesting and it may have some small effect, but it's not the biggest thing to worry about. If you're, you know, concerned about red light and putting glasses on and putting efflux in your screens and turning off your lights at night, but you're still snacking before bed, you're starting in the wrong place. So while it might matter, you know, there are other sleep hacks that can matter for some individuals. Those include exposure to light. Those include ambient light when you're sleeping or having a bed that's cool enough. You know, these can matter for some people, but the big ones are not there. The big ones are food, awake timing, and morning activity. Those are the really, really big ones for circadian, exogenous circadian. And remember, we don't have one circadian rhythm. We've got about 1,000, and they're supposed to cascade and resynchronize day to day. That suprachiasmatic nucleus causes a master signal that causes a cascading, a resynchronization of all the clocks in the body, mm-hmm. theoretically every day.
Mm.
But if you get used to giving your brain circadian signals routinely, like don't eat before bed or get up early and go for a walk, after a few days of this, that's when it starts to work out. So you can do the same thing with supplements. I have a sup for sleep quality. I don't love lots of crazy supplements. I think you can get a large amount of support by, again, circadian signaling, meaning the supplements don't make you tired. But if you take them at the right time of day, after a few days, you start getting tired when you should. The sleep urge builds in. And these are really common supplements. You know, L-theanine and GABA, when mixed together, have a 6 times effect on sleep than either one does alone. Dramatically a larger effect. Mostly because the L-theanine gets through the blood-brain barrier and causes GABA metabolism to start. GABA itself can't move through the blood-brain barrier without transporters, but if you start the metabolism for it, now you're calling for it. So you get this really strong surge of GABA as well. And then melatonin, but not the doses most people take. Most humans, most biohackers are dramatically overdosing melatonin. The only reason to take large doses of melatonin is to shut off cancers. If you're dealing with cancer stuff or cancer risk, macro dosing melatonin may be a very good idea. There's good research recently showing, there's a great study with stage 2 colon cancer where it just shut it down with high doses of melatonin. So there's something there in melatonin. But the maximum human dose of melatonin for blood level is 300 micrograms, MCGs, a third of a milligram. Any more than that, you don't get a higher blood level. You get secondary and tertiary effects, you know, second and third day effects from the melatonin. And another important feature or fact about melatonin is it's manufactured from serotonin. You take serotonin and cut off a part of it, and now you get melatonin. All serotonergic neurons have an autoreceptor, a receptor that sniffs how much it's dumping into the synapse. So if you raise serotonin too aggressively with like Prozac or something, you actually have a drop in serotonin. This is a weird phenomenon, a weird fact nobody knows. SSRIs lower serotonin in the synapse. They don't raise it. They raise it briefly, and then the cell goes, oh crap, too much serotonin, it pulls back.
Right.
And the effect is not on your mood is not the serotonin. It's some downstream effect on the hippocampus causing plasticity. It has very little to do with serotonin. So the same thing's true about all these other species of neurotransmitters. They're meant to regulate. And when you get in there, you know, it's less important that you're discreetly going after any like lever you can pull, and more important, you're moving through the whole system and tuning it. And this is true of the sleep stuff as well as any particular, you know, neurotransmitter.
Just sounds like the golden thread is to learn how to live in harmony. Harmony with nature, harmony with our rhythms, harmony with our brain waves. It's comes back
and to feel them and measure them. I mean, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, we didn't look at triglycerides, you know, and even 30 years ago, your doctor told you about your triglycerides. Now you can get your full genome scan for a couple $100. You can get your methylation status. You can get really sophisticated information. And you can start to become your own expert. You know, we're hurtling towards a time when we're going to be able to ask our computer, hey, what's the best medication for me for this? Or, hey, what do my genes say about this to your like Siri or your Alexa, whatever. And it's going to say, oh, your genes say this. Would you like me to order this from Amazon? You know, it's that's where we're heading very, very shortly. Intelligent avatars who can test our health status against the literature, against the supplement stacks out there. And that's going to mean that this consumer biohacking, this agency we have to dig into literature, to dig into science, is just going to accelerate. So we've had an opportunity to biohack, and maybe we've, you know, maybe we have a responsibility to biohack, to take care of our suffering. It's going to start becoming easy, not just possible and necessary, but easy as we start getting the gap between science and translation into practice, the gap between a finding in a paper and somebody on the street understanding it, those gaps are going away like really rapidly. And so I think we're going to be in a place in a couple of years where all of the supplements, all the interventions, all the stuff we're doing won't be things we're doing because we think we should or because some guru told us, but because we looked at our data and went, oh crap, my behavior is causing this, or my resources look like this, I would like them to do something different. And you'll be able to, and you can do that now with the brain, with neurofeedback. But I really think that the whole landscape of physiology and medicine is starting to make itself more visible. We're starting to understand some of the deepest promises of the science and how that might actually inform the individual's performance. So,
well, I'm really grateful for your time. I want to be super respectful. I'm sure we're just scratching the surface of all of the things that you've discovered in with Peak Brain and all the great work that you do. I have a word here, always better than yesterday. It's called heartprint, and the word is a tip of the hat to a phrase that we used to use in policing, which is that every contact leaves a trace. It's the Lockhart's exchange principle. We used to teach the detectives the Lockhart's exchange principle to get them into the mindset of thinking about, when I go to this scene, where is the offender left of themselves? Like, what evidence am I going to find? But I think we as human beings leave a heartprint on everyone we interact with. And the word kind of symbolizes like a ripple effect, a legacy, the things that we make possible for other people. Andrew, I just wonder what you think your heartprint will be.
I mean, the work that I do is really about giving people, individual people, agency so they can then change their resources, their suffering. So there's this idea, you know, classically meditation is an act of reducing suffering for yourself as well as for other people. If you're less attached, you're less reactive, you're less got your fists up in response to suffering, then you're going to cause less suffering and have less suffering yourself. And the same concept applies to working on your seizure disorder or your cravings or your trauma response. It's not your fault you have a trauma response, but it is your responsibility to learn to navigate it and take control and reduce your suffering. Even if it was caused by being in a traumatic environment that wasn't your fault, you still have the opportunity and the responsibility to learn how it works and to change it. And I find that when individuals change their own resources, there's a cascade effect in everything they touch and everyone they touch gets changed. So having somebody take a 180 perspective from I'm suffering with a diagnostic label into, here's how I'm built. Interesting. Ooh, I want to work on that. Just that cascades out. And now their kid, their parent, their teacher, their friend, their therapist, when they walk into the therapy session, say, hey, my trauma response is doing this. And I'm also impulsive. And can we work on my not feeling safe around my mother-in-law? I mean, they're doing it from a physiologically informed perspective. It's not just about the experience of trauma. They understand learning. They understand how the amygdala works. They understand safety and containers. And that can help somebody accelerate through their own transformation. But if you're like a parent who worked on your own ADHD or drinking or seizures or trauma, and then your kid comes home having a really extreme event at school or something, you're going to know how stress works differently for the kid too, because you learned yourself how it worked. And so, you know, if the kid's dealing with social or sensory overwhelm or something, and you learned how your own social or sensory phenomena work, especially parents and kids, you know, often they have very similar brains. As an aside, boys usually have their mom's brains, FYI. I don't know if that tracks in your family, but that's
interesting.
It's much more than 50%. It's like 90% of the time. It's very strange that a lot of the intelligence, the empathy, the speed of processing, the anxiety, those come from mom, it looks like, in a dominant way. The same way that mitochondria, you're only carrying your mom's mitochondria, none of your dad's. You have no genetic material in mitochondria from dad, all mom.
Wow.
Pretty sure the brain is biased, not 100% the same way, but it's biased strongly towards mom's genes. So the agency is the heartprint, leaving people with a sense of possibility, a sense of power, piercing that sense of overwhelm because they don't know what's going on, that this overarching label is happening to you. That's what I like to leave people with, is a sense of like, well, wait a minute. Oh, this is much more nuanced than I thought. And it's not all bleak. And oh, wait, there's some strengths here. And oh, wait, I understand it now. And hey, this just gave me 6 ideas about things I could do in my life right now. So it's not treating from a top-down perspective. It's being in someone's corner as they move through goals and self-understanding, the same way that somebody walking into a high-end gym might sit down and go over their DEXA scan and bone density and functional strength assessment, and then sit down and talk about what's going on and where the goals are.
Mm.
Not you're overweight, but like, oh, you want to be stronger and have more some body recomp, and oh, you want to be on stage in 6 months, and oh, you know, want to give childbirth without pain and work on the pelvic. Okay, great. Those are great goals. Let's iterate towards them. Gives people agency instead of here's a new label for you. Here's an identity you must take on now. I'm going to be your treatment provider. I'm kind of poking at doctors a little bit, but my joke here is that doctors are wonderful, but they have to be right. You go to them for discrete information, but scientists, you come to us for questions, and coaches, you come to us for techniques, for iterative support. So I like to take a science and coaching perspective for the brain instead of a treatment perspective, because it instantly provides that communication of agency. It leaves that heart print, and that particular heart print echoes. It causes them to do the same thing to other people around them. So
that's powerful. If someone listening is called to engage with your work, either personally or with their business, with their corporate, where's the best place for them to visit and find out more?
Yeah, so we're all over the internet, of course. Peak Brain LA is our first socials. We do have a separate UK presence and companies. You can find us on peakbrain.co.uk or peakbraininstitute.com is the main website. We've got coaches in a few different countries, US, Sweden, and the UK. But most of our clients work with us remotely. So if you're in one of those countries, you can do a rental program and grab hardware, software, and work relatively inexpensively. Well, it's still expensive, but less than you might expect. And if you're in a different country, we can still support you, but you'll have to purchase some equipment. We've got coaches on 7 days a week, more than 12 hours a day worldwide, who can jump in and help you place a wire or refine a goal or, you know, build new neurofeedback protocols. So come check us out at Peak Brain LA and the socials is probably the best place. And we'll add a coupon code as well for the podcast, so folks can get a discount that cuts we have a brain mapping membership at our offices. So if you're in one of our physical offices, you can pay one time and have free access to brain mapping for the year as a tool to keep mapping as you try stuff. And our list price on that is $500. It's cut in half when you're a podcast listener. So in the UK, for instance, Chris can do I think it's £250 instead of dollars. It's, you know, roughly equivalent. But that's an annual where you can have a few maps and get some mentoring and some support. Now, of course, we want to do neurofeedback with you if you want to. But the goal is really to communicate this agency. So if folks are listening and they're curious, come on into the office or give us a shout. We've got partners in many countries we can send you to for mapping, and would love to start teaching people about their brains. So come find us.
Love it. Andrew, thank you so much for your time, brother. I'd be honored if you'd leave us a final thought from your good self.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me. I would say, folks, just remember that whatever you're dealing with, your performance goals, your suffering, it's not how you are always. You know, you're going to change. Shift does happen. Take yours, grab yours, learn how it works. So if you're overwhelmed, if you're struggling, if you're in pain, if you're foggy, the brain loves to change and will change in ways you can stretch it. And an awful lot more is changeable than it's conventionally understood. So don't tolerate your suffering. Don't tolerate being overwhelmed by what's going on. Pain is real, but the secondary pain, you know, there's a concept in Buddhism of the second dart. You hold a coal, you know, or the reaction you have to suffering. You stub your toe and you know, it hurts. You scream at the bed for 10 minutes, that hurts more. Or you pick up, you know, anger to hold at somebody is like grabbing a coal. You burn yourself before you throw it at somebody. The same thing's true of the ignorance. If you're frustrated about your trauma response, that may be adding more suffering to your trauma response. So learn how it works, and you can start to then, you know, play some Aikido on that suffering and take control of it and use its strength to your advantage a little bit.
Andrew, appreciate it, brother. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Hey, my friends, thank you for making it to the end. I hope that our time spent together today has left you a little bit better than before you push play. I'd really appreciate if you just took a moment to leave a review to allow me to meet more people where they are and hopefully leave them a little bit better too. If you're curious to know how I, through Always Better Than Yesterday, can serve you, your team, your organization, then head to alwaysbetterthanyesterday.com to connect. And while you're there, let me know one or two things that you're going to do as a result of listening to this conversation. I absolutely love hearing your thoughts, your reflections, and the things that this spark in your own heart and mind. If you want more insights from my heart and mind, I do send out short episodes on a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, and again, I hope that they serve you well. I appreciate you listening. I'm Ryan Hartley, host of the Always Better Than Yesterday podcast, a podcast for heart-centered leaders just like you. Keep leading, my friends. Always love.